talking about politics, I mean, here you were one of the founders of Twitter, and you've been able to see Twitter change the world. For example, in Iran, I think one could say that Twitter had a tremendous impact. I mean, that movement, the Iranian, you know, protest movement is still alive. Twitter had a very important role in that. What are your thoughts in looking at that? And also, how, you know, did you have the experience of taking examples from those kinds of political movements in your style guide?
So, yes, I did mention Iran in the history of the short format. It's a great case because there was a situation where information flow is limited coming out of the country, and there were just a few people who managed to actually get some text messages out from Iran. And the rest of the activity was people around the world either repurposing that, retweeting it, or commenting on it, or identifying with those people, or giving them attention. And it seemed like there was a tremendous amount of stuff going on inside the country when, in fact, there were really just a few people running around with cell phones, finding outgoing connectivity where they could, and sending in a couple photos and some text messages. And so the legacy is that attention was swarmed upon these people. And I think that's the tremendous power of the format, is that it has this long tail of the web, which enriches what seems to be a very sort of maybe sterile text message. It just gains in value as it gets kind of repeated. And so what I focused on Iran ever since then. I've been watching, and something came up during my travels that alarmed me a little bit, which was a researcher in Amsterdam who is a sociology master's student, and he has determined that using some statistical analysis and some linguistic analysis, he's able to identify people who would otherwise remain anonymous on Twitter based on their writing habits and their associations. And so his example that he chose, because he's a heavy Mac user, he wanted to identify the prominent and influential Apple employees in Silicon Valley based on their Twitter accounts. And I don't know if you know, but most Apple employees are bound under very strict guidelines in terms of what they can talk about, and so they tend to be anonymous on Twitter, or at least semi-anonymous. It turns out this guy is able to identify the top 20 most influential Apple employees and their Twitter accounts in just a couple of days of number crunching and analysis. And
just by analyzing their style.
Yes, and yeah, exactly what they wrote and who they replied to, etc. Mm. And he was encouraged by this, but then thinking about it, he was very alarmed, and he came to me and said, do these guys at Twitter know what they're doing? Because we've created now a system where folks can be identified by their writing. And I felt both, at first, very validated by that, because that's sort of the premise of my book, which is that your writing is your fingerprint in a way, or at least the way you think is very clearly represented. But that I was alarmed because, well, this could be used for great ill. If someone in Iran, for example, really needed to remain anonymous to do their job and to possibly, you know, save people from oppression or whatever, that they could be routed out by someone using a similar system within the regime, identified and, you know, accosted and what have you, because of where they thought they were being safe, you know, because of their patterns of their behavior or what they wrote or whatever, it could be identified. That's a little scary.
Yeah.
So I've been sort of digesting that lesson ever since my trip to Amsterdam in November, and I'm going to try to write it into the electronic edition of the book and sort of understand what that means. I'm still struggling with that. I think I have to sort of do more analysis and learn more about how he's done this.
But, so are you thinking that there might be a way to stylistically encrypt one's work?
Well, so this is part of another sort of thread of the book, which is that I think it is important to avoid danger by to simply craft your own personal fiction, essentially. Protect yourself in a layer of mythology, as it were, about your daily life so that you don't give too much away to someone who may have the wrong purposes.
Wow.
And my wife is very cognizant of this. Every time I post a photograph of our son or of our life, I do try to be an editor and think about my audience and think about the people who may not actually have the best intentions. And this goes all the way to my writing. And this fellow's research really brought that to my attention. And so I think that, and you'll notice this too, as people gain a lot of followers, their writing changes. And I've seen it happen with each of the founders. as they gain an audience that approaches a million, as that happens, their writing had changed.
In what way?
They're just more infrequent, maybe a little more mysterious or vague in terms of what they're doing.
So they fictionalize themselves in a way.
Yeah, in a way. The only exception so far, there are only a few that have actually gone above a million, but Jack is a great exception, Jack Dorsey. He's managed to maintain his personality and his style throughout the meteoric rise in his following count. And I'm impressed, because that's a very difficult thing to do. I have 9,900 people that follow me. And I think they're people, because that number has stayed static for a while. Mm-hmm. And I know new people come and old people go. And for a while, I was gaining a lot of these robot followers. And I do shed them every day, because they either expire or they're kicked off. Mm-hmm. And so, but I'm getting more and more people kind of following me every day throughout my travels. So I'm pretty sure that's a fairly high ratio of actual people following me. And yet I don't know who they are. And I, you know, every time I meet one of them, I'm always fascinated. But I'll probably never meet them all. And so I have to be a little cautious. And so I found that it's a challenge to be transparent and honest and human, and yet still have some sense of privacy. And actually, I was just reading this morning that the Facebook CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, wrote that we've left the age of privacy behind.
And I hope not.
Interesting statement for him to say, because Facebook has a drastically different model for privacy than Twitter.
Right.
Which I tried to include in the book as a style. You can essentially inhabit the space without really being public. And that's, I think, part of its fascination.
You mean Facebook or Twitter?
The short format.
Right.
Because with Facebook, there are many levels of privacy. On Twitter, there are basically two. You can be public or you can be protected. And being protected means that you approve who reads your tweets. And on Facebook, you can have groups, and you can decide that your family or your friends fit into a certain subset to see your updates or your pictures or neither. And to have him say that that the age of privacy is over is actually, it seems provocative, because I think he's trying to pave the way for opening up his service a lot, which is the trend that I see happening with Facebook. It started out as a closed, elite, Ivy League social network before the word social network was really even a term. It was just an online community. And I happened to have access to it because I got my graduate degree at Harvard. And I thought, well, you know, at the time, it was a degree in education, and I wasn't teaching, so I thought, well, the best thing I can do to take advantage of this is join this snobby social community, online community. And I did it out of the lark, actually, but I happened to be one of the first users. So I've seen it evolve over time and open up, and it started out with allowing more different academic institutions, colleges, communities, and then it really opened up entirely to anyone and their mom, and literally everyone and their mom got on there. And my sister doesn't want my mom on there, because she wants to have her social circle to herself, in a way. And it's created these very codified, somewhat distressing kind of social conundrums, which is, you know, how much of my private life do I want to share with my coworkers or, you know, my parents? And I've been watching those collisions as well, and you know, we had one early on with Twitter and the creation of Twitter, and I happened to be part of it. There was a community of maybe 50 to 100 people testing it when we first built the thing, and we, like I was saying, we had to recruit them and basically convince them to join. But we had no monitoring tools, no public stream. There was no way to really even see who was subscribing, and unless you were an administrator like myself, and you could see who signed up. And so I felt, as the head of quality, the only test engineer in the group, that I would follow everyone just to see what they were saying and see if they were complaining. If there were any bugs, I could help to fix them. That was my attitude. But it turns out that certain relatives of people that I'd, on our team, folks that I'd never met, found it confusing that they had this random person following them. And so they started asking questions. Once they understood who I was, they were fine with it. But still, there was initial kind of a privacy issue, we can call it, just a question. And so we created the flag in the system that we called it private, and it was just a flag that I could see as I was scanning the user list to see who didn't want everyone in the world following them. You know, who's a relative, or it looked like you could tell by username who is a relative of whom. And so that was the first instance of what we have now as the protected status on Twitter.
Wow.
And it was almost an afterthought, because we had designed it initially to be open, and the idea was that you would just broadcast to your friends and to the world what you're doing.